Jonathan, alcoholic.
Jonathan.
I want to extend a very big thank you to all of you for welcoming me, to Mark for inviting me. I'm very grateful to be up here and with you tonight. And I usually start most of my pitches this way. It's that if I could have stopped drinking on my own, I would have never, ever joined AA. I'm going to be very clear about this. If I could have stayed stopped on my own when I got out of a detox or county jail, if I could have stayed stopped on my own on those intervals of abstinence that would happen from brief times in my life, if I could have done it on my own, I would have never, ever joined a cookie-eating organization like AA. And we eat a lot of cookies. And it's simply this. It wasn't that I didn't believe the stories that people were sharing. It wasn't that, I'll just call it like it is. I just did not want to stop drinking for the longest time. You know, I could not see a value in being sober. You know, I'd come to these meetings and, even when it was really bad, and I would be like, well, it's still better than AA. You know? And there was a general, an attitude problem that I had with the idea of staying sober. Because that's all it was to me. That's all I could see was staying sober. You'd come up and you'd take your chips. You'd have your 30, 60, 90 days, you know, and I'd see them celebrating the years, right? And they call them birthdays. I thought, how corny, you know? It's so campy and corny. I mean, I thought it was a level of lameness I never even knew was available to me. But I could see you celebrating that time, right? And I thought that's what you had here. And when I stayed sober, it felt like I was doing time. I didn't understand why you'd want to sign up for that. And what I didn't understand is that that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is offering. It's not why you see all these shiny, smiley faces and these beautiful people talking, like Anita, who's talking about being grateful. All right? And it's because Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't offer you time. What it offers you is a program of recovery. And recovery is a little bit different than sobriety. I had to look up the definition of that to really understand what it was. And the definition that I found and I use today is the power to restore something to the way it should have been or the way that it should be. Like, I'd like to be the man I should have been and the man that I should be today. And that's a long, far cry from just being physically sober. You know, they got that old joke, you sober up a horse thief, what do you got? A sober horse thief, right? You know, I know a lot of people with quote-unquote time that I don't want anything that they have. I don't like the way that they live their life. I don't like their values and morals. I think they were scumbags then, and I think they're scumbags now. You know, I'll just call it like I see it, you know? And then I'll see these people, they're chasing after this thing called recovery. And some of them don't even have a lot of time. Some are only 30, 60, 90 days, but they're chasing it. They're chasing after this thing called recovery, and they're working hard at their steps, and they're trying to make their amends, and they're out there trying to help other people. And I would follow them to the ends of the earth. Because this transformative thing that happens to the human heart, you don't find it often. And what it does for alcoholics of my variety is it's a miracle. You know, you throw that word around a lot. Don't leave before the miracle happens. Oh, man. You know, I just heard that line just too many times. It's just, can't do it. Can't do it. But it is. I think back to when I got sober. And I did not believe Alcoholics Anonymous would work for me. I'm going to give you a little bit of what it was like so you understand the type of alcoholic that I was. I identify with Bill Wilson. I identify with Dr. Bob. And I'll tell you specifically the parts I identify with. Bill Wilson took a gin and sedative. to quiet his nerve, you know? And Dr. Bob had a beer and a goofball. Now, I don't know what a goofball is, but I would have done one, you know? And that's the type of alcoholic that I am. And I understand singleness of purpose, and I understand the importance of keeping to our traditions and keeping our talk around alcohol and alcoholism. And language is extremely important. But also understanding the type of alcoholic that I am is important as well. And the type of alcoholics that they were. And here's what it is. It's not an outside issue. It's very much a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's born and bred right from the beginning, you know. We like to do stuff. And so do I. So I'm going to give you some statistical information about me. I think it's important. It'll help you judge thoroughly. You know, the people will tell you don't judge. You know, come on now. It's the same breath they'll say stick with the winners. How are you supposed to do that and not judge? I love all the contradictions, man. I love them. It's so great. It's so great. So I got sober in July of 2002, which means that I just turned 22 years sober, which is just mind-boggling. All right, I got sober a month before my 29th birthday, which means that next month, was born in August, I will be turning 50. All right, which is also just mind-boggling to me. And you know, the day before I got sober, the weeks and months before I got sober, you know, there was absolutely no stopping this alcoholic train. And to give you a vision for you, I weighed about 130, 135 pounds soaking wet. I weigh about 190 right now. So it's me about 60 pounds lighter. My skin was gray. My eyes were sunken in. My hair was falling out from lack of nutrition. I was regurgitating bile in the morning. It's that yellow pungent stuff, you know. I was ill. And I was very, very ill. And the physical parts, that doesn't even begin to describe some of the problem. My behavior was bad. And I didn't grow up that way. You know, I didn't grow up that way. It was not my intention. And then something happened, this thing called a sobriety date. I didn't know it was going to be my sobriety date. I didn't intend it. It was on actually July 6th of 2002. And to give you an idea, so we know the 4th of July happened. Must have been one hell of a party. No, it was dull. The July 4th was dull. It was me locked away in a room with her, because, you know, we like to drink like that, right? And you know, you could hear the fireworks in the distance, but there were no fireworks going off in my life. It was extremely repetitive. In fact, I probably wouldn't have even known it was the 4th of July if it wasn't for the noises outside. You know, because I had already begun to get to that place where you start to lose track of calendar dates and time. You don't know which time of the day, morning or evening, you're in, or what part of the calendar you're on, or what side of daylight savings time. It just didn't matter. It all blended together by that point. And on July 5th, she dropped me off in front of this facility that I was supposed to report to and drove away in the car. Now, it wasn't our car, but there was a car, and she drove away in it, you know. And I was like, whoop-de-doo, she's going back to the pad that we haven't paid for months. She's not going to be living there long. But, I was in this facility. I was doing this intake, if you've ever been to a facility, and they sit across from you, and he's looking through the paperwork, and he says, it says here you got a detox. And he looked up at me, and he looked right back down at his paperwork, and he mumbled something, because this facility had a you had to be sober to enter kind of a thing. And he could clearly see that I was not. And he seemed to overlook this little fact. And I believe that's because he understood our traditions. He understood our primary purpose was to stay sober and to help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. And he mumbled something to me. He said, I can't, if you think you can do a non-medical detox, you can stay. And I didn't intend on doing a non-medical detox. In fact, I had no intentions at all yet, except for how can I get to the telephone. And but I didn't have enough energy to do that. And I wasn't intending on staying. And he kind of rushed through all this stuff and put me in this facility. And as he was walking me in, there was a gentleman that I had known from the streets. And at the time, he had about 4 years sober. And they called him Polar Bear because he was a big guy. And he had these bright blue eyes. And they weren't blue from when I knew him on the streets. They weren't that bright. But they were bright that day because he was 4 years sober. And he looked at me and smiled. And he was the best cheerleader for Alcoholics Anonymous. It was impossible for me to believe this guy was sober. But here he was. He was sober. And he was happy. And something had shifted in me. It was how, you know? And I know this is going to be a little bit out of order. I will go back to what it was like. And that day they had a panel come in. They had a gentleman come in from the outside. He took time out of his busy life, took time away from his simple pleasures, and he came out to share his story. And while there were a lot of things in his story that were not similar to me, he'd been shot. I hadn't been shot at that point. And, you know, he had been incarcerated for extended periods of time, which I hadn't been at that point. You know, he'd been stabbed. I hadn't been stabbed yet. You know, there were a lot of things that weren't in my story, right? I mean, I'm sure they were coming. That's why I use the word yet. If I kept drinking, they were coming, you know. They were definitely en route. And he started sharing about Alcoholics Anonymous in a way in which that I had never heard before. And what shifted in me was this won't work for me to maybe. My entire recovery, my 22 years, is based on maybe. If I do what this guy did, maybe this thing would work for me. And he talked about the difference between physical sobriety and recovery like I did earlier. And he shared about this incredible process of changing. And he talked about all the hypocrisy in AA. There's a lot of hypocrisy. If you want to find holes, if you want things to point out, you can find them, man. They're all over the place. You know, just by the people in it, there's plenty to judge. You know? And he said if you chase after this thing called recovery, half as hard as you chased after the bottle in the bag, you're sure to get it. And I worked really, really hard at staying drunk and loaded. And I could see how that was possible. He said, follow people who follow the literature. People have opinions and they change all the time. The literature hasn't changed for decades and has helped people to the tunes of millions recreate their lives. It's kind of a hard number to argue with. Millions of people recreating their lives. It's kind of hard to argue with. And I had never really followed the literature closely. I never really understood the literature. Never had anyone to really show it to me. Or the people that I was asking didn't know what the hell they were doing. That's for sure. And my recovery started on a maybe. So if you're sitting in here going, I don't know, that's okay. If you're in here going, oh, hell no. That's okay. You're welcome. You know? And if you're sitting here in your last 30 days after being here for a while, and you know what that is, you're just counting the days away till you take another drink because you know it's coming. Realize you can make a pivot at any time. Because in July of 2002, I made a pivot into a new way of life. A way of life that I would not change for anything. There is nothing, including loss, there is nothing that I would want to give up this life for. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. So, I grew up in a non-alcoholic household. I grew up in a solid home, not a broken home. I had a mom and a dad that, you know, and they I had my issues with them, but, you know, they were loving people that had good values and morals. I have two older siblings, a brother and a sister, and they're non-alcoholic. They never had a problem with alcohol and drugs. Not that they didn't do any. They had their their moments, but they didn't seem to have this quote-unquote alcoholic gene, right? Or this alcoholism thing. And there are people that will argue that it's genetics. They'll say, oh, I got it from my father, my grandfather, or something like this. And, you know, and I can't do that. I come from a big family. There's like me and one distant cousin with confirmed alcoholism. And I can't really blame genetics. And then you get the other argument, if it wasn't nature, maybe it was nurture, right? Maybe something environmentally happened to me to make me become alcoholic. And I'll tell you, I don't believe in easy childhoods. I don't think that growing up is easy. I don't think people have easy lives. I think there's difficulties for all of us that we go through. But there is nothing, there's absolutely nothing that I could point to that would have made me alcoholic. And the people in the South have a simple way of saying it. They say, boy, it don't matter how the mule got in the ditch. Let's get it out. Right? It does not matter if it was genetic or if it was environmental. What matters is if I have this thing, if I'm truly admitting, if I've conceded inside that I have this thing called alcoholism, there's only two answers, another drink or get sober and hope to find some recovery. You know, because staying sober without recovery is, man, it's a drag. It really is. And people will go through periods of time where they step away from their steps and their principles, they'll step away from their meetings, and they'll tell you about it. Ask them. I encourage you, ask people about their experiences. I love hearing people's experiences because what can happen to you can happen to me. And I love hearing people's success. I like seeing them overcome things. I like seeing them go from, you know, from prostitute to business owner. You know what I mean? I mean, I guess a prostitute is sort of a business owner, but, you know. But you know what I mean? A legit business owner. I'm not saying that prostitutes are illegitimate. What I'm saying to you is this. I love hearing about transformation. I have a buddy of mine that I helped get sober. He's in my group, and he's got 18 years right now. And he was panhandling on the side of the road, and he was hurting his girlfriend, and he was a blight on his family, and he was in a lot of trouble in life. And flash forward 18 years later, and he's an employer, and he employs a bunch of people. He gives a lot of new alcoholics an opportunity. And, you know, he's got a family. He's got three kids. He's supposed to come up with me tonight, but he's got a birthday party for his twins tomorrow. And he's like, I just can't do it. It's just too late. And I go, don't worry about it. You're off the hook. But I love that transformation, that complete change of being, you know, because if it can happen to you, it can happen to me. And I grew up in this non-alcoholic household. I had a brother who was very good at sports. He was, you know, always a first string, or, you know, always, you know, being celebrated for his sports accomplishments. And, you know, and that wasn't me. I felt I could never be a part of a team. I always felt separated from. I was always wandering off in my mind. I couldn't keep my head in the game. It was just not my thing. And he excelled at that, and he did very, very good at it. You know, I just didn't fit in for me. I didn't get what he got. He got a sense of community from that. He got a sense of purpose. He learned good values from that, right? Not me. You know, I couldn't relate. My sister was very scholastic. She was really good at education, honors, dean's list, that kind of thing. She did very, very well. She got something from that. She got a sense of community, a sense of purpose and drive. It fulfilled something for her. It never did that for me. I could not get into education. It was so difficult for me, you know, to focus on that stuff. And, you know, and it just seemed like the pressure was on. There's a gentleman that was out from over the hill, talks about a spring in your gut that just kind of winds up and it's got to pop eventually. And I was like that from an early age. And there was a group of people that I gravitated towards. And these people seemed to like drink and get high. And that seemed to unwind the spring for me. And it did something for me. It gave me a sense of community, you know. It gave me a purpose. Let's get more, you know. It provided a sense of unity. When I was with you and we were having a drink, man, all of a sudden, me and you were like this. You know, we were tight. And, you know, even if I didn't like you, you know, it was like all of a sudden I'm sharing my dreams and aspirations and desires and, you know, hell, you know, let's start a business, you know, probably an illegitimate business. And I seemed to fit in that world really, really well, really, really well. And, you know, straight out of high school, I met her. And, you know, it was that alcoholic relationship. She liked to drink and get high the way I like to get high. There's nothing like an alcoholic relationship. You can look in each other's eyes and you can just say, it's okay. You know, we're committing felonies on a daily basis, but it's okay. You know, we haven't paid the rent in months, but it's okay. We're lying to friends and family. We're lying to each other, but it's okay. You know? And it just seems like this perpetual, like, you know, if I was trying to do well, she was just like, you wanna? And it was over, right? Or if she was trying to do well, it was like, you wanna? And it was just off and kicking. And you know, we did start a business together. We started selling drugs. It's helpful. Because when you can't show up on time, they're very forgiving. You know, they're just grateful you showed up, you know? And, you know, it helps perpetuate that lifestyle. She introduced me to a triple beam, you know? If you're a little young and you don't know what a triple beam is, ask your sponsors. They'll let you know. It's before digital scales, right? And she had a lot to teach and I had a lot to learn. She was 11 years older than me. It was great. It was great. She'd been around. She knew about a lot of the pitfalls of the alcoholic lifestyle, which helped. It helped, you know. And we were on this path. And I got introduced to, a lot of substances really early on. But by the time we got together, we started messing around with a lot of opiates and stimulants. And I hadn't had a lot of deep-seated opiates, and there's something about opiates that are tough to get away with. They instantly become very much a primary, you know, in my life. In fact, to the point where I just couldn't see myself as alcoholic. You know, I was sober in my first 6 months, and you know, I had my grand sponsor. We were down at this big meeting. We went to go have dinner, and my sponsor's there, and he seemed real knowledgeable. And I said, I don't think I'm alcoholic because of, you know, X, Y, and Z. And he said, that's interesting. And people in AA have some interesting questions. He posed a question to me. He says, what would you do if you couldn't cop? Shit, I drank. You know? That. And then it occurred to me, almost every run I ever went on started at a liquor store and ended at a liquor store. You know, and then he said something else. He says, he didn't know a dope fiend yet that didn't turn into an alcoholic if they lived long enough, you know? And the reality is that there's a reason why it's called King Alcohol, you know? And there's a line in there where it says, alcohol became my master, you know? And alcoholics will relate with this, driven in that lifestyle by this thing that defies any logic. It's a strange leap in logic. You know, my friend Scott used to say it. He used to say, man, this line, I love it. He used to say, I was too drunk to walk, so I drove. I understand that logic. I get it. I've been there. I've absolutely been there. I might not be able to walk, but I can drive. You know, and it's absolutely bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. And for me, we rode really hard in that lifestyle for a long time, and we got into a lot of trouble, and we hurt a lot of people along the way. But we stayed together. We stayed committed. We devoted to the cause, you know? And like I said, she drove away in the car, man, you know? And I'm in this facility, and this guy came, and he's sharing with me, and he's sharing with the group of people that are there. And I'm dying because I'm on, you know, I can't go 4 hours, let alone 4 days. And, you know, I'm working on day two. And I got to tell you, everything in me it's flying apart. But something is getting through when he's talking. Something is getting through. And I stayed. They were actually really kind to me. It was interesting. Like, you know, this kind of facility, they had all kinds of chores and clean toilets and, you know, sweep dirt and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they were kind to me. They really got me a big gulp with some orange juice in it, about that much in there because I was shaking a lot. There were two gentlemen that were people who had time and lost it. They both had a lot of time and lost it. And they were in this facility and they were sharing three cots in a room. So there's three of us. And this guy would come over and I'd be in the bed and he'd hold this blanket over me and hold me down because I would be shaking hard enough. I'd have black and blue marks, you know, from hitting the bedpost. And there was love in these actions. There was love and support because they just wanted to see me get through this. And it didn't happen overnight. It was not easy. It was very, very tough. And I came out of it with this idea. I need to find somebody who knows the literature. And I need to actually do the steps all the way through, you know? And so I went hunting for somebody who knows the literature, right? You know, I mean, it's really easy. I know how to do that. You could drop me in any city anywhere and I will cop. I can hunt. You know, I can hunt down what I need. I can find people that drink the way I drink. Hell, locked up I could find it, you know? You can find it anywhere. So I got to shift now. And they told me that if I'll chase after it like I used to chase after the bottle in the bag, okay, I can do that. I'm going to find somebody who knows the literature. And I started hunting some people down. And I saw the guy who was talking at this particular panel. He was at a meeting. And he's getting ready for the meeting. And I could see he's getting ready. And I'm going up to him. And I'm asking all these questions. And he's just, I can tell he's trying to help. But he's, at the same time, the secretary is coming up. And he's like, here, talk to my buddy, right? And I turned over, he incidentally turned into my sponsor. And I went, this poser? You know? I was like, oh, hell no, not this guy. You're pawning me off? You know? But what I didn't know is this guy was on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. He was picking up 2-3 guys at a time. He was going to meetings all over the place. He was reading the literature. He was bringing a book study into the treatment center. Hell, he was the guy who booked the gentleman that I was trying to talk to for that panel. You know, he was being of service. He was going out of his way to try and contribute and be a part of this thing. And mostly because I was unaware of it, he was running from financial destitute. You know, it's interesting how that'll happen. You'll have something critical happening in your life. And like Anita said, she dove even harder into her recovery. She dove even harder into service. You know, and we were talking about it seems like when life comes up and kicks you, you fall in the direction you're facing. And if you're looking out, you're going to get loaded. If you're looking into service, if you're looking into recovery, if you're looking into this being a part of this thing, you will get further into it. And I'll tell you a little bit about that before I wrap up. But he was there, he was involved, he was doing this stuff, and we would do the campiest stuff. We would sit around this ping pong table in this little rec area and read the literature. And we got to this third step, right? And we start reading the third step. And he goes, let's pray this third step. And we're all holding hands around a ping pong table. It's not how I envisioned my third step, all right? It was campy and goofy and lame, you know? But I'll tell you something. I know that was my third step. I know from the bottom of my heart, that moment, I made a decision. There's a big difference between an intention or a resolution, like a New Year's resolution, and a decision. Decisions are only decisions when they're followed by actions. And I'll tell you, that next day or that next week, I wrote inventory. And I read it to that man. And, you know, and for what it was, as much as I felt like I was doing it wrong, here I am 22 years later. Right? Doesn't matter what it looks like. Hell, when I was doing my fifth step, we were in the middle of I had this grandiose idea of the way I think it should look, and it never turns out that way. It never turns out that way. We're sitting there, we start off in his house, it's nice and air conditioned, and it's kind of dimly lit, and I've got it, and, you know, we're going to start reading this thing, and I'm like, yeah, this is what I'm talking, this is comfortable, I could do this. And he gets a phone call from a gentleman that was part of our group, this guy Gaylord, and Gaylord was a bad drunk, a really bad drunk, and he goes, oh my God, oh, we got to go help this guy. And I'm like, well, we're in the middle of my fist, and he's like, get in the car, just read it to me in the car. And I'm like, this is not what I was expecting, you know, how perfect. Right in the middle of my fifth step, we're out there trying to help somebody. We pull up to this street, and he's walking down the street, wobbling with blood coming down his forehead, you know, drunk. And we get him patched up and put him away back in his sober living or wherever, a safe place where he could basically, you know, sleep it off. And we finish this fifth step, and I'm like unnerved, because I feel like we're doing this wrong. Like, he's not paying attention to me. Like, this is, somehow these steps aren't working right. Now I'm not going to stay sober, and I'm going to panic. And little do I know, things are changing for me. I don't know they're changing, but they're changing. This is only in hindsight. He told me I had to get a job. And I said, does it have to be a legitimate job? He says, yeah. So I get this job. It's a real fancy place. It's called Pick and Save. Any of you remember Pick and Save? They turned it into Big Lots for a while, and then Big Lots went out of business. Don't let them fool you. It was Pick and Save, right? And I'm working at this place as a stock boy, and I got to tell you, I had a $300 a day habit between covering me and her, right? And now I'm working for less than like $125 a week at Pick and Save. You know, it's humbling. And I'm there, and he's telling me things like I hadn't done before. He says, I want you to be honest on the job. I want you to not steal, you know, because he knows me. You know, and he's like, I want you to show up early and stay late and ask if they need anything extra done. I mean, like, things that I just don't do on the natch, right? But I'm hungry for this thing called recovery. And I'm desperate. You know, there'll people that say, I wish you desperation in the beginning. But somewhere along that way, that desperation needs to turn into inspiration, or you won't stay here. Don't think that we all run around as a bunch of desperate alcoholics. Gotta go to a meeting. I get to go to meetings today. It's a pleasure to be here with you. You know? But in the beginning, I don't know that anything has changed for me. And I'm staying early, and, you know, I'm getting there early, staying late, and doing everything I'm supposed to do. And it's getting around Christmas time, and the manager calls me in the office, and I'm thinking Christmas bonus, right? And he says, corporate office called, and they said, we can't have someone like you working at a place like this. And he fired me on just before Christmas. Not with your record, he said. And I went, damn. You know, I was stunned. I was trying to keep the job. And, you know, I was walking home. There's no car. I'm walking past this liquor store. It's got clowns and lights and liquor store, you know. And something occurred to me. I had no desire to go inside. And usually when I got humiliated, when something rough happened in life, that was the first stop on the way to the telephone. I had no desire to go inside. Instead, there was a sane, sound, rational thought. It was, hell, there'll be better jobs. It's Pick and Save. And believe me, there have been. There have been times in my sobriety where I was making a lot of money. And, you know, I wish it would have, well, it kind of did. You know, it's kind of up and down. But, you know, there have been times where I was doing really well. And you know what? If it wasn't for some of the values and principles that I was taught, the determination to work hard. There have been other times where things have been real tough too. And if it wasn't for those values and principles that I learned early on, I probably wouldn't be here sharing with you, you know? And I thought to myself, what was it? Was it that fifth step I did with him? Was it that third step around that stupid ping pong table? What was it? You know, what changed in me? I couldn't identify it. All I knew is that something was changing in me. And you know what? I just kept doing the steps. A little later on, I got another job. I was working at this little office. It was a little doctor's office. It's like a helper, right? And the guy kind of took pity on me. His brother was alcoholic, and he's like, you know, he knew the facility that I was in or I'd been in, and I was very honest with him about my past, and gave me this little job, and I'm working at this place, and sponsors, man. He goes, you know, I was working, at that point in time, I was actually living in transitional living. And, you know, transitional living is interesting, you know, sober living, it's interesting. It's meant to be transitional. There are people that just like set up shop there, they stay there for 8, 10, 15 years. I don't understand that. I just don't understand it. It's transitional living for a reason. You know, maybe it's fear that keeps them there, or unwillingness to do their fifth step or make an amends. I don't know, but something keeps them there. And for me, my sponsor was like, you got to find a place to live. And I'm like, what do you mean? I got a beautiful place to live. I live with sober people, you know, they bring meetings in. I get to go out to meetings with people. And he's like, it's transitional for a living, a reason. Go find a place. Go get your own place. You've been there long enough. And so I'm asking people because, I mean, I got 9 evictions on my record, you know? No one's going to touch me with a 10-foot pole. And I'm in this particular, in this doctor's office working, and one of the patients there comes up and says, I heard you're looking for a place to live, and I got this little guest house, and I want to rent it to you. And I said, no, you don't. And you taught me how to be honest, you know? And she goes, why wouldn't I want to rent it to you? And I said, you seem really nice. I'm an alcoholic. I have a past. I got a record. And you probably don't want to rent this place to me because you're going to run my record. You're going to see stuff that's going to change your point of view. And she said something peculiar. She said, I don't know who you were, but I like who you are today, and I'm going to rent this place to you. Alcoholics Anonymous had changed my attitude towards life, and people were responding to it. And you know what? I lived there for a couple of years, and at the end when I was moving out, because I was going to be with her, the new her, right? And the most peculiar thing happened. She came over, and she shook my hand, and she handed back this mythical thing called a deposit check. Man, I just wrote that off as the cost of living most of my life. I'll never see that again, right? Still a friend and a reference to this day. Right? My relationships with people were starting to have integrity. They were starting to have meaning. And I was starting to make those amends with the family and with the people that I had hurt. And things were changing for me. Big time. You know? There's only about 5 minutes left, and I got to be careful because I don't know what I want to end on. The marriage thing didn't end so well. You know how it is. You know, you meet on AA campus, and 30 days later, you're moving in together, right? You know, 2 months later, you're getting married, you know? And, man, it was a tough divorce. It was hard. It was very vocal. It was very loud. It was very public in the AA community. It was very, very hard on me. It was, in fact, some of the worst emotional pain. It was harder than getting sober on me. It was some of the toughest, because I loved her. I truly loved her. And this was an awful way for it to end, you know? And you know what helped me? Alcoholics Anonymous helped me. Your traditions and your steps helped me. And your valiant examples of service. Because I got this call from this guy who was still drunk, who I had known for a couple of years, who wanted to go to a meeting. And just a couple days earlier, I had moved into that little apartment, had left her, and I was in that apartment, and that apartment had a refrigerator, and I opened up the freezer, and there was a gallon bottle of vodka with about that much still in it. And I like ice cold vodka, you know, in the freezer. And I shut the door, and I didn't know what I was going to do, you know. I mean, don't get me wrong, I like hot vodka, too. Man. But it's in the freezer, and I don't know what to do, and this guy's calling me, and he's drunk, and he's trying to go to meetings, and I'm like, perfect. And I went and picked him up. We'll think about the vodka later. Let me go help this guy. And I go out there, and he's like at this bus stop. I keep telling him, you need to get to this side of town. And it's been like an hour, and he hasn't moved, and I'm like, it's Sunday, the bus isn't running. Okay, I'm driving across town, and I'm picking him up, and we're trying to get to meeting. He's shaking, and he's dying. And he's like, I just need you to stop at the liquor store so I'm not like a mess in the meeting. He said, you know what? I got something for you. And I pulled that vodka out of the freezer, and he just lifted, tilted it up, and man, gulp. God, I remember those days. Gulp. Gulp, and it was gone. And his nerves calmed down. And he goes, let's go to the meeting. And okay, let's go to the meeting. You know? Alcohol is not the enemy here. I know a lot of people that look at it as like the mysterious boogeyman. You know, my brother drinks alcohol. My mom will have a glass of wine. But it doesn't affect them in the same way it affects me. You know? So I stayed sober. And I'm making these amends. And I got 2 minutes left, just about 2 minutes. I hope there's enough time for this story. And one of the amends that I shied away from for a long time was the amends with my father. He died while I was still drinking. I was a blight on the family. I was stealing from that little checking account that they were using to help pay for hospice and medical stuff. And I'd go in and I'd steal his morphine, not because I wanted to leave him in pain, but because that's just what I do, you know. And he was dying in ICU, and I was loaded, and I showed up there, and he passed away, and I couldn't sober up, and I... You know, and it was on my list of things because I loved my father. I didn't respect him as a man. I had issues with him. We had problems, you know, but I loved him. And I didn't know how you make amends to somebody after they passed away, after you hurt them or hurt the family that way. I ran into this guy, Larry, and, you know, I asked him this question, how do you make amends to somebody who's passed away? And he says, oh, you've got to write a letter and bring it to the grave. And I'm like, that's lame. You know, and about a year later, he remembered me, which was amazing. And he said, did you ever write that letter? And I'm like, how does he remember? And I'm like, no. And he goes, write the letter. And another year kind of went by, and I never wrote the letter. He came up to me again. I knew he was going to ask, and he did. And I just put my head down. He goes, I'm coming to your house to take you to the gravesite. Have the letter written. I'm like, man, this is like forced amends. This is not cool. And he showed up. He drove all the way up, man, from Bellflower. And he picked me up in my little guest house. And he took me the couple miles to the gravesite. And he told me to read the letter. And he asked if there were any traditions. And I said, yeah, you got to put a little stone on the grave to remember the person who passed me. He goes, okay, I'm going to find a stone. You read the letter. And I read the letter. It was stupid. And it felt like this was just forced. And like, this isn't making amends. And here comes Larry, he's got a boulder in his hand. I mean, literally, he had a boulder. We put it down, and we get in the car, and we're driving away, and he goes, you know what you did today? And I looked at him with all the attitude of an alcoholic and said, I made amends to my father. And he said, I don't know about that, but maybe for the first time in your life, you showed that man some respect. And he had me. And he says, this is where the amends starts. You need to go and treat his wife, your mom, the way he would have you treat her. You need to go and treat his children, your siblings, the way he would have you treat them. And try that for a year and come back up here and see how you feel. And a year later, after doing that, I came up to that gravesite and I wept. Man, tears poured out of me I didn't even know I had. I moaned and wailed and wept. And another year went by, and I kept treating him the same way, and I went up there, and I was overfilled with joy. And I realized that I was being the man that I should have been and the man that I should be, and anything that was between us was gone. In fact, a new relationship with my father began that day. And I'll tell you, my life has gotten significantly better, incrementally better, and I've been through some tough times. You know, I had some tough times. I had a time where my hand got crushed. I was in pain for 2.5 years. I went through 2 surgeries. They put 23 screws, 3 titanium plates in my hand, and I did it on ibuprofen. All right? With fireballs and lightning bolts coming out of my hand of pain. But I did it, and I recovered, and I got better, and I got through it. And I'm not saying that's for everyone. That's what I know I needed to do, because if you give me an inch, I'm going to take a mile. You know? I've survived a lot of things that people get loaded over. They get drunk over. And I'll tell you, I am so glad, because my life is infinitely grand. My brother is having a child at 54. He's having a child with his girlfriend. I'm going to be an uncle again, not to mention my nephew and niece from my sister are 30 years old, right? What a joy to be able to show up and spend time with my 88-year-old mother. You know, it is incredible. Please stay. Please be a part of this. Please chase after people who follow the literature. Please become a part of this group. Get some commitments. It is absolutely worth it. Thank you for letting me share.